Welcome to Future of Freedom. I'm your host, Scott Bertram. Future of Freedom is a production of America's Talking Network. You can check out all of our great podcasts at americastalking.com. To support great podcasts like this one, please donate by clicking the link in the show description. We bring you interviews today with both sides of the debate over the Biden administration's expansion of the humanitarian parole program to increase the number of legal immigrants entering the United States. In a little bit, we'll be joined by Josh Smith. He is research manager at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. First, we're joined by Simon Hankinson. He is senior research fellow, Border Security and Immigration Center at the Heritage Foundation, more at heritage.org. Simon, thanks so much for joining us.
That's great to be with Scott.
We're talking today about the parole process in the immigration system, which recently was expanded by the Biden administration, initially for Venezuelans, and then extended to nationals of Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua. If you can, tell us what this parole process is, what it looks like, and why the Biden administration is now leveraging it for its use.
Well, historically, parole is one of many exceptions built into this incredibly complex book of laws that we have governing immigration. And, you know, for every single category of visa, every way that you can get in, there's always going to be, you know, odd cases that just don't fit. And so they have these exceptions built in. For example, let's say you were not able to get a visa because you didn't have an embassy in your country, but you needed a life-saving kidney transplant, and the only person who could give it to you was your brother, and the Shriners were paying for the operation, and so there was no reason to suspect that you were going to, you know, come and live here forever, or that you were a terrorist or a criminal. That might be an occasion where the Attorney General back in the day or the Secretary of Homeland Security would say, we're just going to parole this person in. We're just going to stay. We trust them to come in. They're not really in any kind of immigration status. They're not actually admitted to the country technically. They come in, they take care of their business, and they go home again. Another example, there's a criminal case, and we've got a witness who was here as a student a couple of years ago. For whatever reason, they can't get a visa, but they're really necessary for this trial to go forward. The trial is in the interest of the United States or some state. So again, the secretary would say, all right, let's let them in to do the trial, be a witness, and then they can go home again. So and it's written in the statute. It was to be used on a case-by-case basis where it is in the significant public benefit of the United States or for urgent humanitarian reasons. So that's what it's supposed to be. And in the past, mostly it's been used in small numbers, but there have been massive exceptions going back through several administrations, but most particularly under President Biden, where they just declare entire categories of people, like all Haitians or all, people from Venezuela or Nicaragua eligible for parole, which makes a mockery of what Congress intended, and takes this tiny, carefully designed loophole and just drives a giant truck through it. So that's what we're facing today. Biden started using it for I think the first one might have been Haitians. It's been used in the past for Filipino World War II veterans, for immigrant members of relatives of military, U.S. military, Ukrainians, and then most lately Venezuelans, Nicaraguans, Cubans, and Haitians. That was the latest one, 30,000 a month from each of those countries. So the Biden administration has been sued by various states saying, look, this is not legal. So far they're losing, but I think as in many other cases, this administration's general approach seems to be to throw it at the wall and see what happens and then take their chances in court. And that's where we are today.
We all know that there are major problems on our southern border. Is using parole in this manner any worse than what we currently have happening at our southern border?
Well, it's the reason why we're having the problem at the southern border. There's a cause and effect. In the same way that in our big cities, if you tell people that the police are not going to go out and they're not going to stop people from vandalizing, from looting, from jumping up and down on cars, then some people will be motivated to go out and do that. If you lower the or raise the threshold on shoplifting up to $950, you're going to get some people who are going to rob stores blind because they know they're not going to be arrested. You know, humans are, they're motivated by carrots and sticks. You know, I don't believe anybody's fully good or fully bad, but most of us, we do good when we're incentivized to do good. And we can be tempted to do bad when we're incentivized or when it's easy for us to get away with it. And that's what the Biden administration did by telling the entire world, not just people right across the border, but for, you know, from Georgia and Venezuela and you know, any country you can name, because I've seen them myself at the border. I saw people from 16 countries in one night. By getting that word out with the power of social media, they have encouraged people to come because they all know that they're going to be let in. They're going to be paroled. And one thing leading to another, given our backlogs, given our reluctance to actually process anyone to conclusion, meaning to deport them back home, they're going to stay here forever. So I wouldn't say so much that it's a question of one being worse than the other. I would say that one, the Biden administration's policy causes the other, which is these massive rushes of human beings trying to get in.
In terms of how these immigrants are examined and checked, do we get any security benefit from doing it in this parole process way, as opposed to having them, if they want to, simply arrive on the southern border?
No, none. I mean, none that I can see. So let's say you're applying for a visa overseas, which is the way it's supposed to work. You apply before a consular officer. We have your fingerprints. We at least check you in U.S. databases. For some kinds of visa, immigrant visas, you're supposed to show a police clearance, but in many countries, that's pretty much worthless because the records just aren't there. But we at least have some. We got a national ID document. We got a passport. We might have other documents that indicate who you are. There are some ways to verify who a person is when they apply for a visa. We can certainly identify if you've committed a crime in the United States. And if you are a refugee, i.e. someone who's gone through the actual refugee process that the United States has in place, which has worked very well in the past, then you have to be vetted by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services after you're already vetted by UNHCR or some partner organization overseas. Your relationships are verified as far as we can with DNA tests or other means. Your criminal record is checked as far as we can do that. We can attempt to make sure that you aren't a member of some, you know, horrific military group or terrorist group overseas. So there's every effort made to try to vet people who apply for visas or who apply to be refugees. But at the border, what do we have? I was down there. I went to Texas and I went to Arizona in the last 6 months. And in each case, I saw passports, ID cards, coins, paperwork just thrown by the side of the border because people don't want to admit who they are. Now, why would they do that? Because maybe they have something to hide, or maybe they just want to start again with a new name, new date of birth. So they give that information to Department of Homeland Security, to Border Patrol, to the Office of Foreign Operations for Customs and Border Patrol, Customs and Border Protection. But that means they're starting from scratch. They're starting with a completely new identity, which we can't verify at all.
If we shift some of these immigrants away from the southern border to other entry points, is that essentially the goal in your mind of the Biden administration here, to say you don't have to arrive at the southern border? In fact, under the parole process, you've got to arrive via plane, if I've read that correctly. So is this part of an effort to simply move thousands of people who might have arrived on the southern border and have them arrive at different points inside the country?
The overall strategic goal of the Biden administration, as far as I can tell, is to further a general open borders philosophy. They don't believe that anybody should be denied admission to the United States. They believe in unlimited immigration. Now, you know, they can't just come right out and say that because there are laws in place, and I don't think it would play particularly well politically. So you have to bear that general strategy in mind when you look at their tactics. The tactic of this parola-palooza, I call it, is to sort of play three-card Monty, you know, the game they play in New York City with tourists, mm-hmm. where they hide the vault. They really don't like it when every month there are 250,000 people showing up at the border and being paroled in or being released on their own recognizance to show up a year, 2 years, 5 years from now for a parole hearing, when 90% of them, according to DHS's own records, estimation, studies, will be denied asylum and then, in theory, have to be deported. That makes them look bad. It's not covered much on the media for political reasons, unfortunately. But there are still some places where you can see videos of thousands of people showing up at the border every day. It doesn't look good. So by this program, they'll be able to move that ball. They'll be able to have exactly the same thing, which is to say almost unlimited immigration, as many as they can possibly stamp into the country. But it'll be happening below the radar. The figures that everyone is looking at will be going down, and it won't be quite so easy to see all of these people arriving and essentially getting exactly what they would have gotten if they'd showed up between the border down at Eagle Pass.
Talking to Simon Hankinson, he is Senior Research Fellow at the Border Security and Immigration Center at the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org. I don't know the exact numbers, Simon, but it appears that there are more people on our southern border arriving who are not simply, say, Mexicans who are trying to come across, but they're at least claiming asylum from other countries. Is a different approach to immigration needed? Will traditional ways of addressing the illegal immigration problem, meaning more border agents, more barriers, are those solutions still valid at a time when people perhaps are coming here, at least for different stated reasons?
Well, I think the reasons people are coming are the same as they always were. There's always a tiny percentage that are coming because they are genuine asylum seekers. I mean, originally, the system was set up after World War II. So it's for Jews fleeing Nazis. It's for dissidents fleeing communism. That's what the asylum system was really intended to do. What it's now being used for is essentially economic migrants, you know, people who are looking for a better life. If you look at the demographics of the world, the population's gone up. There's unemployment in a lot of countries, not just in Central America, but you know, all over the world. And there are just many, many people who are looking for economic opportunities. So that's, you know, the sending reasons haven't changed. It's just the numbers have changed. They've gone up. And I do think we need to change our strategies. I think the Trump administration perhaps didn't sell it as well as they could have, but they had the right general idea. If someone comes to the United States and claims asylum, what's supposed to happen is they're supposed to be detained. We give them due process. We listen to their case. They have to explain to us why they can't go back home because they will be persecuted on account of five grounds: religion, membership of a particular social group, you know, political belief, and so on. And if they qualify according to our law, which is based on the 1951 Geneva Convention, then they get asylum. If they don't qualify, unfortunately, they have to go home. Now, if they're not detained, they ultimately don't go home. That's been the statistical reality for many, many years. Mm-hmm. That's why the law requires them to be detained. If we were doing that, the word would get out and people would understand that it wasn't worth coming with a frivolous claim as an economic migrant. So that's why the Remain in Mexico or these asylum cooperative agreements or safe third country agreements were effective, because it told people from, say, the Republic of Georgia who are coming here to get a job, or from India who are coming to go work with their cousin in Fremont, California. It told them that, look, we're sorry, but if you're coming just to get a job, you have to try to find a legal channel. You can't come here and make a frivolous asylum claim, get work authorization, and then stay forever. So I think it was a very effective policy. We had policies that worked. You need to combine that with some physical reality, you know, something, but not a wall that's sea to sea, but physical barriers in some places, a wall in other places, and monitoring technology and so on, to discourage people from, you know, just simply walking in like they can do now.
The parole process that we've been discussing, was this process, would you call the parole process successful, effective in the past?
Well, I was a consular officer, so I mostly I did visas. It was the old INS, Immigration Naturalization Service, mm-hmm. and now Department of Homeland Security that did parole. So you would have to have someone request it, just like for visa waivers. If someone had was not able to get a visa because of a criminal conviction or some other serious reason, then they could appeal to Department of Homeland Security for a waiver. Sometimes they got it, sometimes they didn't. I think the system works when it's used the way it was written into the law. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a great believer in laws. I'm a believer in compromise. I think in a country as big as ours, with as diverse a population, you're never going to get everybody to agree on anything. So you have to agree on laws. If I want a speed limit to be 95 and you want it to be 35, you know, maybe we split the difference and it's 65, but we both stick to it, right? And that's what we're not doing on parole. I think the way it was written into the law is an exception in rare cases. was it the decent thing to do, the right thing to do? It's humanitarian. But I think to use it as a backdoor to achieve a political end of massive immigration is, it's a mistake and it's wrong and it's injurious to this country. Surely we can come together and come up with an immigration policy that is in the best interests of this country.
Simon Hankinson, he is Senior Research Fellow in Border Security and Immigration Center at the Heritage Foundation. Find them at heritage.org. Simon, thank you so much for joining us here on the Future of Freedom podcast.
It's been my pleasure.
Now, for an opposing viewpoint on the topic, we talk with Josh T. Smith. He is Research Manager at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. You can find him on Twitter at SmithTJosh. Josh, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Scott. Excited to be here.
Talking about the Biden administration's expansion of the humanitarian parole program in our immigration system, I should say, the New York Times, a story very recently pointing out that this could lead to hundreds of thousands of new immigrants through this parole program. Do we have the kind of infrastructure in place to handle that influx of immigrants?
I think it's important that we start building that today, because I do think there are real worries about how we handle them, where people actually live, where people actually get their food. And I've heard plenty of stories from people like Daniel DiMartino at the Manhattan Institute in New York City. There's real trouble with these kinds of issues. Part of that we should probably blame on the cities that have, you know, restricted housing supply, have all sorts of problems there. But immigration really has got to be a response from the local level as well. And so we've really got to get our system built for that.
This increase in expansion of the humanitarian parole program, why should we want to make it easier for this process to take place? Why is this good policy, not simply for the immigrants, but for us as a country as well?
I think the best way to think about that is that there's no single silver bullet. You know, we're not fighting werewolves. There's no secret weapon. There's only a recipe, right? If you think about it like this, to make bread, you need flour, salt, water, and yeast. If you just have flour and water, all you get is glue. And so a lot of reporting and a lot of discussions have focused on things like Title 42 or border buildouts as the single thing, as the linchpin that's holding the whole country together. I think that's fundamentally wrong. What we need is a mix of border security. We need to spend on programs that work at the border. And we also need to create more of these legal pathways for people to come legally. Here's a really concrete example. You probably remember when the Haitians were queuing at the southern border. Well, part of the reason that they came that way is not just because of the distress and their president's assassination in 2021 and the earthquake in 2010 and the hurricane in 2016. Their history is full of these reasons of pushing people out. But part of the reason that they tried to walk across the border rather than applying for guest worker programs is that they were barred from actually participating in those programs. So it wasn't until 2022 when those programs opened up and Haitians could actually apply for guest worker programs like the H-2A, which is the agricultural visa. So we really have to get our own house in order. And that means opening up legal channels as well.
Many people paying attention will know that the southern border has seen record numbers of both apprehensions and of immigrants coming across our border with Mexico. A cynic might look at this policy and say it's just simply a rerouting of people from the border to other locations across the U.S. People taking advantage of this humanitarian parole program have to come in via a plane. They have to land at an airport. Is this not just a rerouting of people from one place to another?
So I came up in a rural area. There are more cows than people in my hometown of Richmond, Utah. And one of the things you learn in a rural area is that if you want the water that you're putting into your irrigation canal to get to the crops, you have to clear pathways for the water to actually get through. Every time water's spilling out of the canal, it's because there's something blocking it. And that's the U.S. immigration system today. We've really got to open up legal pathways so we can get people where they're needed and wanted. So, for example, Utah has two open jobs for every unemployed person in the state. This is pretty common across the country. Minnesota's Department of Economic Development just released a new report, I think yesterday, about this exact problem. They also have two open jobs for every unemployed person in the state. And so I really do think these kinds of programs, these humanitarian parole programs, they are a backdoor in the sense that we'd all prefer if Congress could get its act together and actually pass reform and create new programs that states like Utah and Minnesota that need additional workers that they could actually use. So I totally agree. There's a big problem with relying on humanitarian parole in the sense that we really need fundamental legislative reform. We don't need more of these executive programs, but they're the unfortunate outcome of having a system where nothing gets passed in Congress.
So absent that reform from Congress that you discuss, is this action by the Biden administration legal? There is action making its way through the court system, but has something like this happened before? Is this action legal?
The legal questions are interesting, important, but I'm not an immigration lawyer, so I don't want to speak to them too much. For what it's worth, Cyrus Mehta and Caitlin Box are two immigration lawyers who wrote a really good defense, in my view, of these kinds of parole programs. But I do think that it's an important question. It's playing out in the courts. But I think that the important thing to look at from my training as an economist is that these programs work. Daniel DiMartino, again at Manhattan Institute, has a new paper coming out soon that shows there's been a dramatic reduction in the number of people trying to cross the border. And that's the real story in a lot of immigration research. We've actually had a doubling since 2003 in our spending at the border. But if you look at the number of people that could come through guest worker programs, there's been no similar increase. So we're spending a lot more at the border than we used to, but we're not getting the results. And I'd say that's, again, because we've overinvested, or we've only invested, I should say, in border enforcement issues. Those are important, and we need to keep doing that, but we've also got to add in the second component. And these humanitarian parole programs already seem to be successful. It's really short. You know, they just started in November for more than just Venezuelans and Ukrainians, but I think that there are promising initial signs that everyone should get excited about.
Talking with Josh T. Smith, he is research manager at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. I want to ask a couple of questions about essentially fairness. First of all, is it fair to those immigrants who are coming on this humanitarian parole program to offer this, which is 2 years? There's no guarantee of renewal, but renewal is possible. It could just be temporary. Is it fair to offer them this opportunity for 2 years and then perhaps expect them to go back where they came from?
I think that it's certainly not as effective as an economist to do these kinds of temporary programs where people are uncertain. What's really good for policy is if there's certainty. And one of the really interesting findings from immigration research is that temporary guest worker programs where people can come work in the U.S. and then return home have been really effective at actually reducing illegal flows. And so I think we really should be investing in those kinds of things first. The humanitarian parole program as a substitute for that's not so bad. Like I said, it is reducing the number of people who are coming from the countries that qualify for it. But at the same time, we really need to invest in long-term thinking. That's going to mean creating these kinds of programs that provide the workforce that American companies need to be competitive, that American companies need to pick the crops that you and I enjoy every night at dinner. But we really need to figure out legal pathways. It's never going to be enough to just spend at the border. It's never going to be enough to create these executive programs that are temporary and are going to certainly disappear depending on who wins the presidential election. So I think there's certainly an element of fairness that we can all get behind here. We need congressional reform, not just executive action.
Also on the topic of fairness, if this does end in, as the New York Times says, hundreds of thousands of new immigrants taking advantage of the humanitarian parole program, is it fair that potentially, I don't think we have an answer on this yet, but is it fair that potentially resources are then diverted from other immigration paths, for example, you know, visa applications, people who are doing it the way that people would try to come in before the expansion of this program? Is it fair if resources are now diverted to this new program?
I think it's totally agreed on by almost everyone that we need to do more to shore up our asylum system. That needs to look like these things like the CBP One app, which is where people can submit information rather than just show up at the border. U.S. immigration law right now to qualify for asylum, other than this new CBP One app program, requires that you actually be at the country. You have to be in the U.S. to claim asylum. That's not a good way in a world where we have easy methods that are electronic for people to submit information in advance, but it's also not a good solution for those who are already waiting in the backlog. So there's something like 1.6 million cases in the asylum backlog. that's an important problem to solve as well. We need more immigration court judges. And one of the exciting efforts there is the Dignity Act, which is a Maria Salazar out in Florida proposed along with a group of bipartisan representatives. I think that's one of the things we need is more immigration court judges and a better immigration court system that can process those claims faster. Part of that's going to be modernizing. It's going to be creating more of these apps so people can submit information in advance and not just walk across the border and claim asylum. But this is means congressional action once again. We've got to get more support, and that's ultimately going to require an expansion of the system.
Do we receive any kind of security benefit in your mind from the expansion of this program? Do we know better these people who are coming across and coming to our country?
Yes, I agree. The humanitarian paroles program already requires a sponsor, for example. So that sponsor has to go through a security vetting. We also know who they're naming and who they're bringing into the country because of that. So I think there's important benefits there in terms of security. But also think about it simply like this. We already saw a big problem during Title 42 and during big border surges in that now we pulled people off of the actual borderline and we had Border Patrol agents sitting at desks doing paperwork instead of patrolling the border. That's a big problem. That's the kind of border non-enforcement that everyone should be concerned about because there's a lot of research. For example, Pierre Renes, who's a Federal Reserve economist in Dallas, has a great research paper about how those Border Patrol agents are actually a great way to deter people from trying to cross. So if we want to know who's coming, we've got to invest in systems that get Border Patrol agents off their desks and into the field. I think those are promising options.
What does success look like from this expansion of the humanitarian parole program? What do you hope that it might look like in 2 or 3 years if things go according to plan?
I think it's going to mean that businesses, my mother and father-in-law run a chocolate company here in Logan, and they can't find people to hire to save their bacon, right? There's no one around to actually work. And that's because Utah has 2 open jobs for every unemployed person. In the same way, businesses across the country are having this problem. So this success, I think, means helping find avenues that Congress can make into real law instead of just executive policy.
You've talked a number of times about reform and congressional action. It's been years, Josh, decades even, in which we've essentially said the same thing, that Congress needs to act. If the public put such a priority on changing the immigration system, wouldn't we have some sort of action by now? Is this as important for Americans as it is for perhaps a certain subset of Americans?
I think you touch on something really interesting and important in understanding immigration. It is strange that in Ronald Reagan's administration, if you look at the polling, immigration was less popular than it is today. If you look at it, you see that there are people in the 80s when the big Amnesty Act was passed, immigration was less popular. Today, we can't even pass simple reforms for, say, DACA or the Dreamers who were brought to the U.S. as children who are a few months old, few years old, and have now grown up as Americans, basically. So there's a really big puzzle and an important one here. I don't have the right answer, I don't think, on why it is that immigration reform is so difficult to pass. But I think everyone can see the sorts of results of not getting something passed. You have no new legal pathways to come into the country. You have stymied or sort of stagnated, even on the high skill end with H-1B visas, which are the people who have at least a college degree, if not a master's degree or more. We have the same skilled immigration system that we had before the first iPhone was released. And that's a problem. Unless everyone is happy to go back to iPhone Gen 1, I think that illustrates the kind of problems and the need for congressional reform.
Josh T. Smith is research manager at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. You can find him on Twitter at SmithTJosh and the Center for Growth and Opportunity at CGOUSU. Josh, thanks so much for joining us here on The Future of Freedom.
Thanks again for having me, Scott. It was great to talk with you.
We thank both our guests on today's program. Simon Hankinson is Senior Research Fellow at the Border Security and Immigration Center at the Heritage Foundation. That's heritage.org. And Josh T. Smith, Research Manager at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. Find Josh on Twitter at SmithTJosh and the Center for Growth and Opportunity at CGOUSU. For more episodes of the Future of Freedom podcast and other fine podcasts from America's Talking Network, check out americastalking.com or wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you for listening to Future of Freedom, presented by America's Talking Network.